folks, welcome to the 2021 first episode of Long Shots. I have with me Mr. Sharath Thupran. Hey Sharath, how's it going, man?
It's going very well, and another fantastic year of podcasting, hopefully, and we're beginning with a former banker and a finance company, so I'm happy to jump on board on this one.
Absolutely. I mean, but you know, you should really be careful before calling any year fantastic. End of 19, you were like, next year is going to be the year. And a lot of things happened. Huh?
Yeah, well.
We have with us Tushar Agarwal, the founder of Stashfin. Tushar is, as Sharath described, a former and present financial services professional / entrepreneur. He started his career, I think, at Goldman Sachs, then moved to Lehman, then was at General Atlantic, was at Everstone. We are basically shown off that we have gone through his LinkedIn profile in great amount of detail.
Yeah.
And he's been running Stashfin for almost close to 5 years. Hey, Tushar, how's it going?
Hey, thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And we can kind of, you know, give a shout out to Parikshit from Stashfin, who we met, I think, almost more than around 1 year, 5 months ago in August.
Yeah.
Parikshit also is a co-founder at Stashfin. So it's good to see the main boss on the podcast now. Come over.
Two different perspectives.
So we are all among equals.
Yeah, I know. I realized that immediately after making the hierarchical comment.
Two vantage points spread out over, let's call it 18
with
months.
Three co-founders and all of us share responsibilities.
Absolutely. Tushar completely steered away from my deliberate attempt at humor. Anyways, Tushar, obviously, you know, Stashfin, like last time we spoke about it with Parikshit, super, super fascinating business. You know, in terms of looking at the online lending space at large, things have obviously changed a lot in the last 1.5-2 years. How as a CEO would you describe what you do? That's a good way to kick this off.
Sure. Look, thanks again for having me. Look, I think the broader opportunity which we saw many years ago when I moved back to India from the US was that the current great offerings were just really in the favor of the large lending institutions, which were namely the banks. And there was very little focus, perhaps, on the product differentiation or the set of offerings which consumers really wanted. I had a pretty hard time foreclosing my car loan. I had to go to a loan processing center, stand in line for a couple of hours, only to find out that the center shuts at 1 o'clock instead of 4 o'clock, which the bank shut down. So we felt there was a real opportunity to kind of service customers who were in need of credit, but needed credit at their own terms as opposed to what the lending institutions got involved in. So look, the journey has been pretty exciting. We've been now in our fourth year of running. As you may have already known, we have seen a couple of cycles come our way. Demonetization was one, GST was second, the IL&FS crisis was the third one, and now hopefully the pandemic is behind us. So my job really, I would say, apart from the chief child keeper, I'm also involved in making sure that the lights running and the business keeps going and our users stay happy.
So you know, obviously, you know, when you hear the word lending, and when you especially hear the word online lending, I do realize that I understand that Stashfin looks at both the online as well as the offline world. But typically, when the online lending terminology is thrown in recent times, there's a lot of confusion at the retail level on what online lenders do. I mean, recently we obviously saw the news where Google kind of banned a lot of lending apps from the App Store. There have been, allegations of harassment. There have been allegations of online lenders working outside the quote-unquote regulatory footprint of the Reserve Bank. There's again a lot of confusion on where the regulator is when it comes to these platforms. And, as a customer, often you kind of, you know, interact with the online lending apps almost thinking like the credit risk from a counterparty perspective is coming from who you're talking to, while it might be coming from somewhere else. So how do you kind of, you know, put Stashfin within this entire ecosystem, in this very rapidly evolving ecosystem of online lenders, you know, from a value chain perspective?
Look, I think you're right, absolutely right. It's a very evolving value chain system. Look, what we do for a living, as you may know already, is, and just to kind of give you some perspective, is we offer a credit line card, which has a couple of benefits for the users. One of them is that the card can be used across any POS machine, e-wallet, or online merchant. In addition, people can also choose to withdraw cash free of cost from any ATM whatsoever. The card carries no annual fees, no commitment fees, and folks can really choose to borrow in incremental 1,000 rupees to as much as a couple of lakh rupees in one go. It's fairly instantaneous. It takes about 4 or 5 seconds to go to the app, and then another 2 or 3 seconds to load the card, which can be used across any merchant and platforms. And then the interest rates typically would be much lower, much cheaper compared to a credit card. It still amazes me that in this stage, transparency and all the information out there, people are still paying 4 or 5% a month to a credit card company, or 55% APRs. Still amazes me. Our rates are usually much reasonable, and also the product is much more accessible. Look, the genesis of this venture really came down from we want to make sure that credit was accessible across any format, not sort of based on where I have an e-wallet or where there is sort of a POS machine. And this card allows us to do exactly that. Coming kind of to your question, which is around the ecosystem, look, our view very early on was that if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it is a duck, which means that there is no shortcuts to lending. It's a regulated industry, and we need to really be principal lenders as opposed to platform or lead generation platforms in the model we chose to adopt. So we are regulated by RBI and NBFC, and we lend from our own capital. I think, as you rightly described, there are multiple different formats out there. One format, as in the old parlance, would be something of a lead generation platform, a DSA, where the platform is sort of acting as an intermediary between a lender and a borrower. And typically, the relationship is somewhat episodic. It sort of happens on a one-time basis, and then they move on. And then there's another variant out there, which is, you know, there is still a sort of platform in between, but there is maybe a more of a regular sort of feature set where the platform is also collecting money on behalf of the lender. Look, I think for consumers out there, I think it's very confusing, and it's important for consumers to ask the right questions. We have been very transparent about sharing you know, who our lenders are, which is our own balance sheet, but it's true that it's confusing in terms of where the ultimate risk is coming from and who's sort of placing the collateral. The RBI actually has been fairly, I would say, forward-looking. The regulations in India are sort of much more advanced compared to the United States in terms of fair practices, in terms of lending, what you can and cannot do, what time of the day can you call borrowers, what kind of information can be shared. I think the challenge, as you may imagine, in India is really on people adhering to some of the regulations. But the regulations are pretty explicit about what lenders can do. But I think this sort of cleanup, which is kind of happening, is really a positive for the industry.
Right.
And I think consumers will eventually benefit from this sort of cleanup.
And, you know, since you're guys lending, how do you go about pricing your products? Like, what is the business logic there, and how much does it vary from, I'm sure it varies from borrower to borrower, but how do you sort of think about it at a, you know, very generic high level?
Sure, look, our APRs candidly range from as little as 12% per annum, so as little as 1% per month, mm-hmm. to as much as 4% per month, depending on the risk quality. I should have mentioned, the other feature of our card is that people can also get lower interest rates as and when they build a better repayment history with us.
Sure.
So we're actually one of the only lenders, at least to the extent I'm aware of, where we actually actively go out and price our loans lower without any input or requests from the user. We do that actively on our own, proactively on our own. Look, the way we think about risk is that ultimately we feel that it cannot be one size fits all, which means that folks who have a high credit rating, who've worked very hard in paying that bill, their sort of obligation on time, should not bear the brunt of folks who are just about, let's say, starting on credit. As you may know, in India, about 400 million people have access to no credit from the formal lending ecosystem. And therefore, it's very important that that risk of late payments or potential defaults gets priced in. The way we do our pricing is based on a combination of income, combination of what kind of repayment history folks have had, what kind of credit history they've had. And then basis that, we will put that in a black box and then price the loans also based on the loan tenors and how large the obligation they're taking on at that point in time. So it's purely risk-based, and as people pay back and have a better repayment history, then they're able to get a lower price loan as well.
But I mean, it's interesting because like, you kind of are pretty clear from day one that you are in the lending business yourself. And underwriting is kind of, there's obviously technological and pricing end of underwriting. Mm-hmm. And then there's the actual, balance sheet end of underwriting. And a lot of the tech enabled lenders probably focus on the former, but not on the latter. But you kind of are pretty clear from day one that you look at both, right?
So look, I mean, if you think about the opportunity in India, as you may imagine, the market is relatively cash strong, right? There is very little excess assets the country has. If you, we need funding from the government to fund airports, bridges, roads, highways, and, SMEs, and there's so many opportunities to kind of extend credit.
Right.
So it was very important for us to, unlike some of the Western models where there's excess liquidity to some extent, and a lot of the work is really involved in finding the liquidity, finding the home for liquidity. We felt that it's very important for us to focus on both ends of the spectrum, which is pricing the risk, also some bit of fraud detection, but also making sure there's money in the bank to lend on further.
Yeah.
A lot of the NBFCs and banks, as you may imagine, the demand far out the supply, and so really supply of capital is much more equally important than just sort of pricing the risk as well as underwriting the loans.
Yeah. From an old school perspective, typically loans were, people were borrowing to build an asset or invest in an asset, be it an auto, be it a car, or be it education. But these days you see, there's a trend, call it cultural or not, but there's a lot of borrowing going on for expenses such as buying a depreciating asset or maybe traveling, right? There's a lot of different use cases of that have emerged in the last few years. How do you sort of, factor that in? Is that a concern at all in terms of buyer behavior, and what exactly is the borrowing going for? Like, I can, 10 years back, it was unheard of people taking credit lines to travel. This has become quite a common theme, right? Even buying iPhones has become, which is a depreciating asset, it depreciates to zero in 3 years. So does that at all change the lending mechanism as such?
Absolutely. Look, I'm glad you asked the question. It's really hitting the nail on the head. Look, so in some ways, if you think about the ideal borrower or the ideal customer for us, someone who should not want money, because if people have transparency in the cash flows and they have visibility to how they're going to spend the money, chances are they won't need any kind of financing from us or anyone else to meet the needs. I think the challenge comes in where people need some kind of bridge financing to meet their expenses. So, for example, my employer may delay my payroll by a week, and I need some capital to bridge my expenses. Or, for example, there's real opportunity cost where if I buy a real ticket for a family of four in the summer of 2020, it's likely much cheaper than buying it, let's say, a year later on the spot. Mm-hmm. So I think those are the use cases which excite us,
yeah.
Which is really help people bridge their needs for consumption as well as the opportunity cost financing. But look, to answer your question, the business which we are not in, and that's the reason why we offer this credit line card where people can have the flexibility and freedom to spend the money wherever they choose to. We don't do iPhone financing. We don't do CD, consumer loan financing, but we do really believe that really artificially perhaps lowers the barriers to buying something which people can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
And that may lead to an adverse sort of selection where people just sort of borrowing money to meet an expense or meet a consumption or lifestyle which they can't afford.
Sure.
So look, we made a choice very early on that we should give the power in the hands of the consumer, as opposed to getting into the business where artificially you may seem very appealing that you can buy a, I don't know, Galaxy S31, whatever the model is out there, you know, like, let's say 1,000 rupees a month or 10,000 rupees a month, which really, really, in a way, is artificially making it attractive, but you are shedding out a lot of money to buy a device which you may or may not need.
Yeah.
So that's really why we were offered the credit line card and don't do kind of shiny iPhone 10, 11 financing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like if you look at neobanks as a standalone models, like most, a lot of the neobanking platforms which have lately been kind of, you know, evolving, they kind of have a, they have a banking partner. They, at the end of the day, become like an origination channel for a banking partner, right? Whereas whereas you guys have already taken a step further ahead in the sense that you are kind of in the business of underwriting and the business of lending yourself. When you kind of describe yourself as a neo bank, is it more in the confines of the strict regulatory definition of a neo bank, or is it that it's just a new way of looking at lending as a product line?
Look, so great question. And so look, the way so a couple of questions there. Let me address the first one first, which is that look, in our view, the lending or the banking opportunity in India doesn't necessarily have to be adversarial, which means that it doesn't necessarily have to be the banks versus the fintechs or the banks versus the NBFC, etc.
Yeah.
I think this is a great opportunity to collaborate. And I think the banks are doing an awesome job in kind of building a low-cost deposit base, which is also looking for yield. So part of what our platform does, which is lend from our own balance sheet, is also allows people to get access to higher quality, higher, bigger loans at a lower cost through our banking partners. So it is not just sort of adversarial in the sense that it's our loans or our balance sheet or no one else. So when I mentioned earlier that people can get a lower price loan, we actually solicit actively banking partners so that our customers can get access to lower cost funds, even if it doesn't mean getting funds from us as they graduate and as they move up in their careers. So I think that's a key differentiator of the platform, and that's something we're really excited about, because since we got started, over 1 million customers have come so far, and almost about, I would say, 250,000 customers have actually gotten lower price loans proactively from us as they have moved ahead in the journey. So something which we're very, very, very proud of. The opportunity we see over here is to offer both sort of payment as well as lending services without being constrained by the bank. If you think about a product, what we find is that a lot of banks may or may not have restriction on which ATMs folks can use, what kind of fees they pay for it, how many cash withdrawals they can make in a month. We don't think that consumers should be constrained by these choices. So the reason why we offer the credit line card is that we work with existing banking infrastructure, but people can change the PIN anytime they want. They can take out cash from any ATM as they deem fit to do so. They also can choose their own reward points. They can refer their friends. They can lock the card, unlock the card. They can see the transaction history. And then they're also able to sort of plan ahead in terms of cash flow planning, which I was mentioning earlier, which their banking current bank may or may not offer. So I think it's a combination of lending, but not sort of in a way adversarial with the banks. It's sort of making sure that there are an answer of features with the underlying infrastructure, which is bank grade, which is owned by the banks.
But like, how do you kind of, you know, what's your take on, I mean, just cost of capital, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, the regulatory regime in India has over time made sure that, you know, when it comes to like the cheapest sources of funding, scheduled commercial banks already always have an edge, right? And do you see a problem with that overall thesis in general? Or do you think, you know, the RBI is being overtly conservative there? I mean, obviously, being conservative is not necessarily a bad thing for a regulator. But I mean, as someone who's close to the market, Do you see specific segments or use cases where such a hardcore demarcation may not necessarily be required?
Look, I mean, my personal view is that there is obviously trust deficit, which has come up in multiple industries and multiple regulatory changes over a period of time. And based on what has happened in the banking sector the last couple of years, I would, you know, reckon that maybe they were not as conservative because, you know, people did sort of lose some money along the way with very heavily regulated banks. So I think I personally welcome regulation because it kind of, in a way, you know, perhaps reduces the cost of doing business because only scaled players can survive. But look, I think you're absolutely right in assuming that the banks obviously will have the lowest cost of capital because of the regulation which or the trust which they inspire with the depositors. But look, for every deposit, there also needs an asset.
Yeah.
And therefore, we come in, right? So I think the partnership we have with the banks and banking partners, we have co-lending capital that allows us to tap into a low-cost deposit base, which necessarily, which means that we don't necessarily have to go and kind of raise copious amounts of deposits or liabilities because the banking partners are helping us fill the void.
Right.
So I think it's a co-creation opportunity, which we're pretty excited about, where both the banks and NBFCs like ours can partake in the opportunity together. We think that the risk modeling, the customer acquisition, the experience, something which is very core to us, can enable banks to build a retail portfolio along with a capital participation from our side.
And, you know, like... Where do you sort of see the business evolve in the next 2, 4, 5 years in terms of StashFin? Like, is it a matter of just gaining more and more subscribers, increasing the loan book and sort of more underwriting, more money? Is that sort of the way to go? Or is there a more, you know, direct targeting of making a pivot into something else or just understanding the customer end to end and sort of going deeper within a customer? Or is, what is the thinking there in terms of, you know, vision for the next 5 years, so as to say?
Look, so the business is evolving, as I mentioned. You know, there are 4 or 5 sort of major macro events which have really made sure that we've stayed on our toes and have, I'm glad we came out fairly successfully out of those. I think the way we think about this is kind of a combination of what you kind of described. We clearly are hungry to expand a base. We are acting, you know, adding more than 50,000 users a month, maybe in some cases more each month. And that's very important to keep increasing the base, to increase the offerings. When we first got started, we were lending in one city, now we're active nationwide. So it's important for us and to service our users and to expand the base. But what we also find an unique opportunity is in affinity banking, where we feel that certain segments of society need maybe somewhat customized solutions. So we have one program which is just getting launched, which I can't share at this point in time, which is really meant for certain service forces, people in the forces,
right,
which we find a very compelling opportunity because those set of consumers and users have a very specific need regarding you know, phone banking, app banking, as well as funds at a certain cost of capital. So we're pretty excited about doing that. But that's a very affinity and niche kind of business within our customer segment.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, our goal is to also expand our user base by adding more users to the platform.
And, you know, 50,000 subscribers are being added. That's fairly impressive. Like, how are people discovering? Is it organic discovery or do you spend a lot of time in marketing and advertising the product out there?
So look, I mean, currently, as you may already know, we've been really in this sort of stealth mode for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
We have, as a company, chosen to, if you think about the pillars of lending, which is customer acquisition, underwriting, risk modeling, and liabilities,
mm-hmm.
We have chosen to spend our time on the latter in the initial part of the journey, which is risk modeling, underwriting, as well as collect billing and collection infrastructure, as well as liabilities. It's only now where we have maybe started speaking about ourselves and reaching out to users. A lot of our users are word of mouth. We have a great referral program. People can refer their friends and family, get rewarded for that. We also have a partnership with Payback, where people get reward points for using the card. Some of our reach outs have been to employers, where people have HR teams feel the need to reward the employees by offering a free card, which is free of cost, has no kind of commitments of any kind compared to other products which are out there in the market where there's typically a catch. Mm-hmm. The catch typically means that it's free for the first year and then it's not free for the second year, or the catch is you've got to spend a certain amount of money, or the catch is that, you know, you get it, but then it's free, but then there's a letter you get in the mail and then it's no longer free and you won't pay attention to the letter and you got it, now you start paying sort of some hefty fees.
Yeah.
So our commitment of making it free of cost for life has really allowed some HR partners of ours to give out, push this product to their employees. Mm-hmm. And that's how people reach out to us. And we have done some selective partnerships with online aggregator platforms as well, but those have been somewhat episodic.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our growth has been somewhat organic.
Yeah, there's a lot of plays in India now. Some of them position themselves as neobanks, some of them underwrite, some of them don't even underwrite, they're just aggregators or matchmakers. Do you see like the big banks or even private sector banks sort of come downstream and try to get a piece of this pie? And you know, at some point of time there has to be a justification for a partnership to work, but is that an area that these bigger banks would like to,
or even big tech,
or even big tech for that matter, right, to sort of exploit? There's no shortage of cash for the big tech guys to underwrite. I mean, that's something that Nikhil and I talk about fairly often. It's, not to paint like a risky picture, but that's something that would excite the big folks as well, right? I mean, at some point of time, how do you see that like play out like in the marketplace?
So, couple of questions there. So one is that, clearly, by virtue of regulation or virtue of size and scale, as you think about the market maturing, as it reaches maturity, most people will play in the area of strength. We think our area of strength are customer acquisition, user experience, underwriting, risk modeling. Mm-hmm. So when we work with banking partners, those capabilities already exist with them, but it may not make sense for them to, let's say. So I think what we found is a marriage between areas where they may feel that it's not perhaps worth the time and to augment their sort of capital base with a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important to make sure that, you know, we're not sort of offering housing loans for 1 crore rupees, 10 mm-hmm. lakh rupees personal loans. You know, mm-hmm. we really don't think we have an edge there because that's the area very less sold by the banks. But for smaller working capital requirements of, let's say, 10,000 rupees to about 3 lakh rupees. Those are kind of areas which we think we can serve best. And if you think about sort of for the banks or the large lending institutions, they have a cost of capital, which is the funds, but they also have a business to run, right? Leases, yeah. Retail leases, personnel costs, they keep growing every year, right? So it may or may not make sense for them to partake in such small opportunities. But look, this opportunity also is not a winner's take all, right? This is a... Sure. A $10 trillion opportunity where a number of folks will partake in it together. India is really at a unique point where 20-30 million people get added each year in the new to credit segment who graduate from schools and colleges. There are about 250 million people who are sitting in schools who will be coming to the workforce at some point in time. So I think it's an opportunity where all of us can jointly work and make this happen. And the same kind of goes for, big tech or other lenders or other opportunities, other folks looking to partake in the opportunity. It's not a one search engine or one shopping platform. A number of us will be coexisting as market expands.
I mean, if we kind of look at your target market, I mean, what exactly, you mentioned obviously from 10,000 to 3 lakh, I mean, we obviously, within the Indian context, we do realize how underpenetrated the credit market has been at a retail level. But, on the other end, not maybe in lending, but if you look at something like, investing, there are only 55 million mutual fund holders in the country. There are 29 million Demat account holders in the country. So, I mean, we are looking at roughly 5 to 7 crore. Within 100 crore plus population who actually are trading actively in the financial markets in one capacity or the other. There is underpenetration, but there's also reason why that underpenetration exists. And I'm guessing that same parallel also plays out within the lending ecosystem. So, like as Stashfin, from your vantage point, what are the kind of typical, you know, customers are in terms of, you know, their profile, in terms of the demographics that you guys look at most often? Are they like millennials? Are they young professionals? You know, are they guys who already have credit cards and they like Stashfin because it's just a cheaper, more value offering? How do you kind of see that come across?
Okay, so look, I think from an asset perspective, which is folks looking to invest in the market, they may or may not be parallels. I think it's a combination of access to capital, access to awareness, and also the cost of getting into the markets. Look, I mean, for all the experience I've had working in investment banking on Wall Street, you know, it still is a pretty, it's still, as you guys may know already from your podcast and your series, which you're doing an amazing job at, it's fairly hard to understand about companies, you know, earnings transfer not available, you know, there's very little equity research. The top 150 stocks get traded every day, but there are a lot of stocks traded by appointment. So I think it really is not for the average Joe to kind of jump in, and they need a lot of help.
Yeah.
And I'm glad platforms like yourself are making that access available and making it easy and simple for people to understand. But look, I think from lending, there are two aspects of it. One of it is awareness, which is a combination of marketing, a user base, you know, referrals. And the second is cost of operations. Look, so remember that you know, the smartphone or sort of 4G or 3G penetration in India is fairly new. And what we've been able to do is reduce the cost of operations by 100. Compared to traditional banking loan,
right,
by being a digital first. So if you can shave off the costs of branches and security guards and, you know, lockers and strong rooms and tellers, you know, you can really pass those benefits on to the consumers. So I think we're pretty excited about the opportunity. The demand, as you may know already, outstrips supply. So the parallels may or may not be exactly true compared to, say, equity investing. But coming back to the question which you asked, which is the user base. Look, our sort of user base are people who are generally wise about financial decisions. People who are looking for, who may be aware about the costs of, let's say, dealing with traditional financial products. Who need a customized solution. They don't want sort of a one-size-fits-all. So our user base is typically folks in their maybe, you know, graduated from college, their, you know, second, third job, four, 5 years experience. They are very aware about, they obviously are very digital savvy there because they need to come to the app to avail of services. They've spent a lot of time researching on the internet or through their friends on what products out there exist. And then they made a very value choice of, working with someone like us to really get a very customized solution to the need. So, for example, as a platform, we don't charge any foreclosure fee, which means that people can come in, you know, avail, you know, amount of choice, and then if they choose to, they can also pay it back in a very short period of time and not incur a very hefty foreclosure fee.
Right.
So therefore, the commitment of getting in and getting out isn't very strong compared to banks, where typically even a 4 or 5% foreclosure fee just to avail services, which I find, by the way, very preposterous. That, you know, if you are borrowing money, you know, and you want to pay back money ahead of time, which is usually a good thing, right? You got to pay a fee to pay the money back on time. So, look, I mean, the reasons like these is why we exist and why I chose to give up my career in Wall Street to build this platform out.
Right. But is there like a, like you mentioned, you briefly alluded to the education or the awareness end of things. I mean, obviously, in the markets, it's completely something which is very essential, which actually acts as a kind of access barrier. But even in lending, like the kind of thing that you just mentioned right now, you know, that a lot of first-time borrowers might not even be aware of it, right? That what's the value add that comes through it. So is that something that how do you deal with that problem? Do you yourself, you know, get into the act of information dissemination and content, or do you depend on third-party providers to just make sure that people understand the? Because it's, I mean, lending might be a simple-sounding product compared to a typical, a market instrument, But still, there are many levers and buttons which can be pressed here or there, no?
Right. So there are, as you may imagine, it's a lot of information to give out, and it's also, you also have to be careful about information overload. And a lot of times, information may not be relevant. So, for example, if I'm, looking to, get a very high ticket loan from a bank, it may or may not make sense for folks even deal with us, because we may not be able to match the cost of capital and their expectation of interest rate, etc. But look, I think what we focus on to some extent is to really making sure that there are various hooks which people need. For example, someone may need the feature of security, which is, hey, I left my card in the cab. I can't find the Ola cab's number. Can I block my card temporarily? Compared to a bank, if I were to block my card, maybe it'll take me 2 weeks to get a new card, and they're going to charge me $400.
Right.
So people just need the ability to block their card temporarily while they may be sitting at work, and they can do that. The second feature set which we find very appealing is that a lot of our customers don't want to deal with us on the phone. So they want to have a chat system where they have a record of the communication they've had with us, as opposed to speaking to an agent on the phone. But they're in a subway, they're in a metro, they're in a bus. They want to be able to kind of deal with us without having to take out time with the busy schedule. The third feature is expense analyzer. People can spend time of any kind, how they're spending the money, how they can maybe make better decisions in terms of how they're purchasing groceries, etc. The fourth feature is a free credit report. Sometimes people just want to know the health of the credit system. So I think depending on what users want, we'll kind of make that feature obviously available to them. And hopefully, look, as you said, as a period of time, as our base increases, all those feature sets may get more prevalent, and more people get more informed as the business grows. But we don't spend at this point in time any time on kind of really reaching, broadcasting all the features of the card, because we also feel that to some extent there's a lot of information for people to kind of chew on.
I mean, but it's super interesting, because the next point that I wanted to ask you was that, when it comes to tech-enabled products, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, you, for instance, as Stashfin, you would like to become pretty much a funnel for the customer, not just from a lending perspective, but also from an expense perspective, from a, expense management perspective, from a financial health perspective. And, you have kind of brought in those extra features and functionalities to probably become a kind of one-stop shop for the customer, and become an interface for any sort of a transactional interaction, and I guess that is probably an ongoing cycle, right? I mean, it's an iteration that we keep on doing, because otherwise, technology-enabled fintech, especially fintech products, they very quickly become commoditized. They very quickly, you'll see many fintech providers, they'll all have snazzy-looking apps, which are, very, very user-friendly, great amount of focus on the flow of information that comes in and out. How do you make sure that, you are kind of ahead of the curve there? Otherwise, aside from the pricing, aside from the commercial aspect, those hooks are important to make sure that the customer stays and the retention is there, right?
Sure. Look, great question. So look, I think your comment is spot on, that whatever's bright and shiny doesn't always work. And I think that has been our experience overall. Now, let me give an example from my personal experience. There's a general tendency to assume that the banking apps are not perhaps as savvy, etc. But look, it works, right? And my parents are transacting on HDFC's bank's app, and so do many of my friends. And as long as it works, I think people are okay. And can the user experience be better? Maybe, but a lot of it is good to have, but not maybe required. So I think you're absolutely right in assuming that we have to constantly innovate. 80% of our headcount budget is on tech and data sciences. A lot of our features which have been added to the app, or our features of the platform, have come from the users. So it's really people requesting those features, and then we kind of keep adding them along the way. I think it's absolutely important we keep innovating, and that's exactly the game of the day, which is, our customers may not be looking for the cheapest loan provider. They may not be looking for the best one, the quickest one, the fastest one. But a lot of times folks are looking for what works for them. And therefore, it's very important for us. And for example, and for that matter, any fintech business to be constantly innovating. And that's really listening to our customers, right? So as customers keep adding, asking us for more features, that kind of gets implemented. So something as trivial as something like a card block, right? It's something which we had to find a very kind of a rough API workaround, because that feature doesn't exist.
Right.
We work with Visa very closely. It's very hard to kind of not issue a replacement card the way the banking infrastructure is built. But, you know, look, I mean, I would want to have the feature, right? If I go to a gym and I leave my gym bag unattended, I don't want someone to print the copy of my card and then buy it online.
Yeah.
I just want it to be safe.
Yeah.
I want to have the mental peace of mind. Something on flow closures. We realized people said, look, you know, why should you be charging us money to pay you back early? And they're like, look, that makes sense. We did incur the cost for servicing you, but you know what? The right thing to do would be to allow people to pay it back early, and therefore we enable that feature. So it's absolutely right in assuming that we have to keep innovating around the technology feature set, the product feature set, to make sure that our products still appeal.
You mentioned that a large part of your headcount focuses on data science. Now, obviously, you know, when you look at big data, when you look at artificial intelligence, I mean, those are, words we kind of anyways hear a lot in mainstream. But when it comes to them being translated into actionable use cases, that's where the insight actually comes in, and that's where the picture becomes very clear. So, in your experience, I'm assuming a lot of the data science goes into giving a customized offering. Or something else? I mean, how does it really work at your end?
Look, so there are multiple use cases, but the two broad ones would be ways to improve operational efficiency and reduce costs,
right,
and pass those savings to our customers, or to perhaps underwrite better and to get to a point of view without asking for a lot of information, but inferring that information. So let me give you an example. So for example, one way we get a lot of people making payments to us on a daily basis.
Right.
One way of kind of managing to make sure that our systems are up to date with payments people have made is to have a couple of people in the room, maybe in Excel sheets, making sure that the payments are attached to the right account. Other way could be that we look at semantics, we look at sort of OCR, CAT recognition, and then be able to kind of match that maybe at 80-90% efficiency or accuracy with our database. Other feature could be, 10 people are asking the same question in the chat,
yeah,
or, this comes to up multiple times. Can someone flag that? Maybe we can make a video around it, maybe make it faster, quicker, and cheaper for people to understand that. There is also a lot of operational efficiency in terms of, maybe let's say we are delivering a car to a person. A lot of times, as you know, the courier guy will call you and ask you, where are you standing? Where are you based out of? Maybe we can just load something in the app and people can pinpoint the location and drop a pin, very similar to how you navigate Google Maps. That makes it cheaper, quicker, faster as well. Then comes on data sciences. We spent very quickly you realize that I'll be out of my depth over here, but we spent a lot of time in building lookalike models.
Right.
So maybe if person one works for ABC company, person two comes in the same company, maybe we don't have to ask the same information over and over again. Maybe we can just sort of assume that some of the information is similar.
Right.
If we have to make a customer support call, if someone has a lunch break from 1 o'clock to, let's say, 2 o'clock, maybe it doesn't make sense to call them at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when their phone might be in a locker or they might be busy. Maybe it makes sense to only reach out to them at that point in time. So a lot of the operational efficiency allows us to reduce our costs and then pass those savings on to our borrowers.
Right, right. We've kind of, gotten a very good sense of the overall space and, how you as a specific player is navigating around it. What's your, you know, how do you see the evolution in the future? You know, in the sense, from more from a regulatory standpoint, you know, in terms of how, like for instance, I mean, only recently, the Reserve Bank also, you know, set up a working group to kind of come up with an assessment of digital lending at large, and come up with rules within 3 months. And I'm assuming, like, when it comes to stakeholder engagement, like companies like yours also have a some sort of a platform to, you know, give your experience or your observations on that specific issue. Number one, is the RBI, I know that's a tricky question, is the RBI receptive in general in terms of stakeholder engagement? And secondly, what's your initial sense of where the regulator is overall headed, specifically within the digital lending ecosystem? Because I think there's a lot of apprehension that we don't want to repeat the, you know, Chinese peer-to-peer model in our country, and hence some regulation would come in. I mean, I recall a few years ago when, you know, peer-to-peer players had come in the beginning. I mean, you know, one friend of the RBI did come in, they stepped in, said that, look, you guys need to be an NBFC, you guys need to put in X amount of minimum capital. And I assume that that ecosystem has now expanded beyond peer-to-peer into all digital, you know, lending scenarios. So what's your, like, as a founder, what's your view on how things are panning out there?
Okay, so look, as a founder and also a member of society, the societal costs of, let's say, bad regulation are far higher than the cost of regulation which fintech players may bear. So let me give an example. So let's say someone gives a loan out to someone who's coming out of college, and the person cannot pay back on time. That imprint on the bureau will last them probably for a lifetime. It can affect the ability to get a job, be able to kind of work in the mainstream workplace. And that education isn't, that sort of information isn't necessarily available to all consumers. So I think there is a need for greater awareness and transparency, and also access to, unfettered access to data. Until, you know, I don't know if it's still true or not, but until a couple of months ago, it was fairly common for a couple of guys in the room to be able to pull bureau records of consumers in the country. You know, the bureau, by the way, is, you know, kind of, in a way, I would imagine it's like a one-way kind of dialogue. I mean, I would, you know, unless I'm the lending business, I would rarely go in and kind of check up, you know, get up on Monday morning and go and check my bureau report and see what it says. And by the way, even if it's incorrect, I would imagine it'd be very hard to kind of dispute things or make them right. So I think, look, because of sort of proliferation of these kind of practices, important to have some more guidance or regulation. But to answer your question specifically, I think RBI has been fairly, I would say, transparent, has been working very speedily on getting these issues addressed. India is one of the few countries which have a regulatory sandbox. There's a lot of engagement, a lot of stakeholder management. We are part of various working committees, not with the RBI, but with the industry groups, which frequently meet with the senior stakeholders from RBI and the government to kind of make their points known. I think my personal sense is, unlike the US, there is a very high degree of learning which the regulators want to do. There's a lot more opportunities for collaboration, which isn't perhaps possible in other sort of developed countries. So look, my view on this is that some of it is slam dunk. That, look, you cannot charge, you know, 1,000% interest, right? Just cannot, right? Even if the borrower agrees to it. India does have a regulatory rate cap for MFI loans. You know, maybe the thinking might be that folks may not be aware. And in case of digital, because people are somewhat more aware and they may be more financially savvy, there should be a regulation. But I think there should be some, you know, policies and practices people can't do. I think also how people report to the bureau, what's the cost of underwriting they're going through, are they really going through the KYC norm which RBI has laid out, I think is very important. Because, you know, there's also the area which we haven't really spoken about, which is ID theft, right? So, you know, someone, let's say, impersonates you as a person on a boarding platform and then runs with the loan. Guess what? You are the one holding the can, right? You are the one who's sort of responsible making sure that your bureau records are clean. And for no fault of yours, right? You didn't take the money never came to you, but now you are the one. and all because a lending platform did not do the basic due diligence and KYC checks of giving money to a person.
Right.
So I think some of it is already out there in terms of regulation. People weren't following it. Some of them may not maybe be clarified, but I think some oversight, would be probably the right thing to do from a societal point of view.
Well, you know, no wonder my last credit card got rejected. No, it's a joke. But
you should apply for a credit line card.
Yeah, I think that's especially the foreclosure and the APR argument is too solid to ignore.
That's a free annual fee for life.
There you go. No, I mean,
and I'll personally deliver the car to your house. That has to be a plus point.
Sorry, what?
I'll personally come and deliver your car to your house. That has to be a plus point.
We can also position podcast as an attractive customer acquisition tool for potential guests going forward, eh?
We always welcome the users.
There you go. And this was exciting, Sharad. What do you say?
Yeah, no, it was fun. And it's always, lending is interesting and complicated at the same time. So it's always fun to chat about it.
Yeah, I would say a fairly cerebral first episode for 2021. And we have the Shah to thank for it. And I hope you also enjoyed it as much as we did. And we obviously learned a lot of things. And I hope our listeners are also, plugged in to figure out how the market operates in this seemingly simple sounding space.
And how to get credit at comparative rates as well, I guess.
There you go. And with that, I think I can sign off. What do you say, Sharad?
Yeah.
This is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off. Yeah.